Welcome to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. This is the second in a three-part series focused on climate change and its consequences. In particular, we're going to note that women in the Global South may be the first to feel the effects of climate change. After all, they're the primary caregivers and often the providers of food and fuel and water. However, they're often excluded from conversations about climate change. Joining us to discuss women and climate change are Musimbi Kanyoro. She's president and CEO of the Global Fund for Women. She's joined by Mary Robinson, the former president of Ireland. Moderating the program is Heather Grady, vice president of Rockefeller Philanthropy Advisors. This broadcast is made possible each week by the generous support of VMware and the Draper Richards Kaplan Foundation.
We're discussing climate justice and women's role in ensuring a better future for us all. And we're also going to talk about Mary's new book, Climate Justice, Hope, Resilience, and a Fight for a Sustainable Future. This book just came out this past week, and I must say, Musimbi and I both received advanced copies, and we have read it, and it's really an incredible book. So, Mary, you are known as a real icon in the field of human rights. I would say the preeminent leader. But in your book, you talk about a moment in time where you suddenly realized how important climate change was, and how I think you say it's the most important human rights issue of our time. Can you talk about the moment that really dawned on you? What was it that happened?
Well, first of all, I missed it. When I was serving as UN High Commissioner for Human Rights for 5 years, from 1997 to 2002, I never really linked the injustice of human rights and human rights, the injustice of climate change and human rights. I just didn't get it. It was partly because there was another part of the UN that was dealing with climate change, and we were in our silos. I was dealing with human rights, gender issues, disability, et cetera, and there was another part dealing with climate change. And it was only when I set up the organization that you worked with me in, Realizing Rights, that we were working on health issues, on women, peace and security, on right to food. And we were a very small organization, so we had to partner with a lot of partners, including Oxfam and other partners. And we were traveling to different parts of Africa. And everywhere I went, I heard the same sentence, more or less: things are so much worse now. We don't know how to cope. And when I probed, it was everything that had been predictable was now unpredictable about climate and weather. When to harvest, when to sow. When I went to Liberia and would meet with Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, and we worked a lot in Liberia for Realizing Rights, I would have breakfast with Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, and she said to me, "Mary, when I was growing up in Liberia, we had two rainy seasons, and they were so predictable. They came within days, and we knew exactly when we would sow and exactly when we would harvest. Now it's completely changed. I don't know when the rainy season will come. I don't know for how long. I can't even mend my roads." So that was her perspective. And then the other perspective was the one I learned from Constance O'Kellett. Is Constance with us?
Yes.
Ah, Constance, my friend.
Hi, Constance.
Constance is in the book. I learned from Constance O'Kellett from Eastern Uganda, whose story is in the book, and she's much better than the story, but we did our best to tell her story as well as we could with her. And, when she had a terrible storm in 2007, floods came to her village, destroyed her village, destroyed all the houses. She moved away from the village for a short time, then came back. And on the first night, there were 27 people in her house because the walls were there. The roof, I think, had been destroyed, but at least there was something there. And she talked about how she recovered from that. And we must have you talking this evening, Constance, because you're a great voice for yourself and a great friend. But I remember Constance saying, and it stays with me, "We thought God was punishing us, and then we learned it was the lives of rich people." Mm-hmm. And then Constance went to her first climate conference in the capital of Uganda, In Kampala, and then became a climate-wise woman coming to conferences on climate, and her voice is a very important voice in that. But all of that I had missed, and when I learned seriously of the injustice of climate change, the fact that it disproportionately affects communities, that people who don't drive cars, don't have central heating, don't have big manufacturing, are so buffeted and don't even know why. Think God is punishing them. Think this is something, have we done something wrong, that everything has changed? And it became for me an extraordinary human rights issue, gender issue, issue of climate justice. And I'm now so aware that this injustice is not really being addressed in our world. It's not really being understood. And we need to do it in a development sense. We need to ensure, for example, that the benefits of clean energy get to poor communities. Mm. And yet, they don't, actually. The amount of climate financing that gets to distributive off-grid finance is minimal. Mm-hmm. There are big mega projects, but there's very little for the rural communities to have homes with solar panels, to have clinics for medical reasons, you know, so that women can have safe childbirth, schools that would benefit so greatly. None of this is happening at the pace it could happen. And there are still hundreds of millions of people who never switch the switch for electricity, never get the benefit. And so I have a passion now to see that that could change and that we could actually recognize that's the quickest gain that we could have to get the benefit of clean energy to the communities that have the injustice of suffering from climate change.
Mm-hmm. Musimbi, do you have a personal story around climate change you want to share?
I could tell you 20, but...
Can you choose one?
yes. Mm-hmm. But I want to pitch them to Mary's book because there's a way in which when you realize that what happens up in the climate, what happens in the environment really joins us and goes to prove that we live in one world. I could tell you a story of the fact that I grew up in a rural farming area. We planted lots of pineapples, lots of maize, what you might call corn.
This was Kenya?
Yeah, yes, the good country. So, yes, really always had plenty. I never had or knew that people stayed hungry, because if you live on a farm and you plant what you need, you eat from that. Hmm. Today I go back home and I find the place where the rivers used to flow in the area, the rivers are dry. Hmm. So people have to find different ways of getting water. And the way they do it now is to dig under so that the wells can bring water from under. But what happened to those rivers makes me really sad. Yeah. As children, we had, for example, each child would be assigned a little garden on which to plant your own whatever that you wanted to plant, whether it was spinach or onions or tomatoes. But the intention was to see them grow and be really like vibrant and nice. And it's not possible to do that easily without having some irrigation. Mm. So the whole issue of the change in the environment in which we live is so real. In my country, again, you asked me to give a personal story. I was very surprised that this year, a Canadian person whom I have known as living in Kenya and goes to Canada in wintertime said that it was really cold and she had to wear warm clothes. When you hear a Canadian person who comes from a snowland saying that it was cold this July, something is the matter. Yeah. Mm. Because that wasn't always the case. That wasn't always the case. So there is something that is really, people can notice it. they don't always say what it is. We at the Global Fund for Women, we realize that when you are working with communities, it's not so much that they have to name it in the terms that we know, like climate is changing or things are drying, but they experience it. They can tell. They can tell whether cold seasons are longer. They can tell when they don't get the rains on time. They can tell when you have shorter dry seasons, for example, etc. And they know something is wrong. So what we do at the Global Fund is to realize that their experience requires listening to, believing them, and finding ways to support them. And how do you support them? It might be that they need to have seeds that are much more resilient, that can be able to align, to adapt to the different changes. It might be that what they need at a particular time is to protest what is happening that is wrong. For example, if there are low people who come from various places and they want to cut the trees, many of the programs that we support, whether they are in Central America, in parts of Asia, in parts of Africa, are women who are resisting the cutting of the forests, the vegetations, cutting them to export wood, cutting them to sell firewood to other places that are far away, cutting them to build cities, cutting them to make these spaces become what is so-called developed, when it's actually underdeveloping.
And sometimes they risk their lives and their livelihoods by defending the water and land rights and forest rights.
Exactly. Yes. They get killed on the front line. We're very present with those kind of women and men and communities because we believe that their voices need to be heard. They are leaders. Those are the leaders that Mary has put in her book. And those are the leaders which, when I read the book, I hear her speaking for the communities that we at the Global Fund and other groups of people really feel aligned and in support of for their work, to really make sure that their voices are heard, and they are heard not just where they are heard in places where decisions are made. So I was very pleased to know that the women that are in this book went to Copenhagen. They went to the meetings in Nairobi. They went to the meetings in New York. Because this is important to hear those voices speak for themselves. And that's the kind of work that really resonates with who we are as justice people. And I wanted to conclude on that by saying when Mary uses climate justice and when we use justice, we have to remember that justice implies that there is injustice. Justice requires that something, there is imbalance somewhere. And so the whole work of justice is to create an opportunity to get the balance that you need. And this balance is important for the environment as it is for people.
Yes, thanks. I want to come back to that, but I want to shift for a moment to the question of women political leaders who are also mentioned in your book. You mention early in the book, Mary, something called the Troika, the Women's Troika, and then the Troika Plus. And then this is about women who are negotiating in the UN the UNFCCC, the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change. And then toward the end of the book, you talk about Christiana Figueres. And all of these women are also heroes to us. And you mentioned she has a plaque on her wall that reads, "Impossible is not a fact, it's an attitude." So you and other women, Musimbi and others, worked both publicly and behind the scenes on really influencing from what were some early losses in the UNFCCC negotiations to coming out with a Paris Agreement. And Christiana, of course, was one of the architects of that. I think we'd like to know, what creates that sisterhood of leaders who are pushing on the negotiations? How do you keep that momentum going? Is there a special handshake? How does that work?
Not a handshake, but actually a realization that it's different for men and women, that actually climate change in many, many of its impacts is worse for women because of social different roles locally. because women have to go further for water and for firewood if there's drought. Women have to put food on the table. Women, even in hurricanes, can't run so fast in a long dress, can't climb trees, keep, you know, are focused on their children and die in much greater proportions. And so a number of us recognised, especially after the kind of breakdown of a good sort of progress at Copenhagen. I mean, Copenhagen, yes, we got the Copenhagen Accords, but the UN system was suffering from smaller, vulnerable countries being shut out of the room, etc. And so the next conference was in Mexico, in Cancun. And there just happened to be a number of women there who were playing leadership roles. Notably, three women had either chaired or about to chair the three conferences in a row. Mm. Connie Hedegaard had chaired Copenhagen before she became the Climate Action Commissioner of the European Union. Patricia Espinosa was chairing as foreign minister in Cancun, and Maite Mashaban was about to chair in Durban the following year. And those three women were on a platform. And I remember it was the current woman who's about to be the president of the General Assembly, Minister Espinosa of Honduras, who said, why don't we form a troika of women leaders mm-hmm. on gender and climate change? And Patricia Espinosa said, as the minister, as the host of the conference, yes, why don't we form? And as Realizing Rights, we said, well, we can provide secretarial support. And you had a lot to do with how we did that as managing director of Realizing Rights. But what we realized was that if women as ministers who were at the table, who were in the conference, who had the capacity to take decisions, who could actually ask their delegates to do things, if we could take this on as an issue, maybe we could make a difference. Mm-hmm. And we actually made an interesting difference at the next COP after Durban. When we met in Durban, there were 40 either ministers of environment or energy or climate change, or heads of agencies like Helen Clark, head of UNDP at the time, Famzili, head of UN Women. And we also had a number of men ministers. We kept men strictly in their place, of course, but we did acknowledge that they should be included, and they were. And in Durban, we planned to have a stronger decision about women being involved in delegations in committees and structures of the Conference on Climate. And so we came with our revised and strengthened decision, draft decision rather, to Doha. And Christiana Figueres, whom you mentioned, had been very involved in this, and UN Women were very involved. We had all the brain power devising this. We got the European Union, Union members to adopt this on our behalf, on behalf of the troika of women leaders on gender and climate change. And when I arrived in Doha, I got a strong message, an urgent message from Christiana Figueres to come to her office. There was a problem. So I came to Christiana's office and she said, unfortunately, a lawyer in the European Commission office, because the European Union were going to propose this, a lawyer had looked at the small print of how you put forward decisions at a COP and discovered that if you put forward a draft decision, it shouldn't basically be decided at the same COP, which was what we were determined had to happen for various reasons. And Christiana said to me, Mary, I'm afraid it's almost impossible. And luckily I said to her, Christiana, define almost. And she said, well, if the president of the conference decides that we could do this and sees there is support in the floor for that, maybe it would be possible. So the chair of the COP in Doha was the minister from Qatar, who was a man with a moustache, not a woman. And so we had to work on him. We had to work on all of the delegations. And I still remember the incredible emotion when this motion was moved by the European Union on behalf of the Troika Plus of women leaders on gender and climate. I think Grenada was the first voice in. Japan came in, the United States came in, Iceland came in, Mexico came in, the various from all parts. And then South Africa held back. Ambassador Siko of South Africa, who had been very involved in the Durban conference as the climate envoy of South Africa, and she knew exactly how to play this. And she waited until everybody else had spoken, and there was clearly a lot of support on the floor for this decision. And she said to the president of the COP, she said, "Mr. President, you know that three women have presided over three conferences on climate, but you can do something even more for women than those three women, because you could take a decision now that this draft decision would be put for consultation and would go to the SBI, as it was, to go to another body and be part of the climate, and that we might have a decision at the end of the day." And it was like theatre. He threw up his arms and he said, "What can I do, a mere man?" And then he looked down and he saw what Christiana Figueres had written out for him. "I see that there is broad support for this. I now refer it for..." thing. And it took 6 hours of discussion and thing, but there were women there, and we got this reinforced decision, which Christiana has always called the Doha miracle. So that was the first victory of the Troika plus of women leaders on gender and climate change. And then with the broad constituency of women, we worked for the gender action plan, and now gender is very much part of the... Troika then took upon itself a very important message, which was, okay, so we've got the gender action plan, but who are the voices that we're to hear? And so now the Troika is very keen that women ministers bring the consensus and the Hindus and the other women that are in the book to the table, bring them as delegates.
Here's a question. As soon as something is called women's, the attendance becomes predominantly female. Although I must say we have a lot of men in this audience tonight. How can we focus on the importance of women in finding solutions to global problems without isolating women from the central conversations? So Constance has managed to do that in her community. I think, can we talk a little bit more about how that happens in central governments or at the negotiating table?
I'm so keen to, get this idea of climate change into people's lives in a way that's real to them, that I've engaged now in a podcast. A year ago, I didn't know what a podcast was because I'm old. And I'm doing this podcast with an Irish woman who's a comedian living in New York, Maeve Higgins, and she has done quite a few podcasts, so she's used to podcasts. And the point about it is that what we're trying to do is to say climate change is a man-made problem, but that does not exclude women. You know, man-made includes women. And we need a feminist solution, and that does not exclude men. And we're trying to kind of have a conversation about how... we can have a progressive solution based on equality between men and women, but looking towards, with a particular climate justice approach, obviously. Up to now, the women that we've interviewed have the mothers of invention, that's the name of the podcast, that we've interviewed have been women. But in New York, we're going to have a man mother of invention. And what we're trying to do is precisely get away from the idea that it has to be women who only address so-called women's issues, and to broaden it into a concern about the issues that Constance has been talking about, the issues that we all need to be talking about in different ways. Mm-hmm. And so in our episodes, we've talked about divestment, and I took part in a press conference here about divestment, and it's very good to see how much that is accelerating now, the divestment and investment in clean energy. What we're trying to do is really get a conversation going that will bring home that this is something we all have to get engaged in. It's not a women's issue as such in any sense, but it's an issue for everyone.
Mm-hmm. So women as catalysts, but not,
yes.
not the only
and
ones.
As leaders.
Yeah.
And as leaders. Yeah.
Musimbi, anything to add to that?
That was very well said, but I could say that some of the spaces where women have come as spaces for women have been really spaces of women getting energy from each other and getting the facts right. But they have not been spaces meant to stay that way. Women gather to think about how the world could be inclusive. And they gather to think about how they could be able to bring those agendas that girls and women have experienced that often have not found their place on the main agenda. And they gather to say, how can they get the wisdom, the energy, the strength, the skills, and the knowledge to also be at the tables where the decisions are made. But it's always been to do this so that the world can become more inclusive. And for those of us that work, say, in women's organizations, women's movements, and women's funds, every day we want to be out of work. And we want to be out of work by seeing our communities and our societies and our family more embracing, more inclusive. Sustainable development goals for me have been part of that hope, because in every sustainable development goal, I see opportunities for everybody. Mm. And I see opportunities for women and men together. And I like also for the fact that in sustainable development goals, we deal with that other thing of the north-south, poor, rich, because all these binaries make us poorer people. And the moment we deal with these binaries, we become better together, better across gender, across race, across anything that you can imagine. And that's, I think, how the world was supposed to be. So let's keep working on it.
That's a great, great thought. Actually, we had another question from the audience specifically on the Sustainable Development Goals. If you don't know what they are, they're 17 goals that the world, all the world's governments have signed on to achieve by the year 2030. And the question was specifically, how has the growth and the development of the Sustainable Development Goals informed your work on climate justice and women's rights?
Yeah, it's a very good question, because I think the important thing about the 17, as you say, Sustainable Development Goals, which is quite a lot, and it's quite complex, but it was a negotiated agenda, the 2030 agenda. It was negotiated by 193 countries. Mm-hmm. And that means that, it was messy, and it was long, and it was, and we were trying to, you know, influence that there would be a climate goal, because initially it wasn't obvious that there would be a climate change goal as one of the 17. Mm. And I'm glad to say it's there, because that then links with the Paris Climate Agreement and makes it easier to see that as part of the sustainable development. And the goals of the Paris Climate Agreement show that we have to be rigorous. We have to cut the emissions to stay on course to be well below 2 degrees of warming above pre-industrial standards and work for 1.5 degrees of warming. Like both of you, really find that the goals are very meaningful, because they go beyond the idea of the earlier goals, which were the Millennium Development Goals, were only for developing countries. These goals are for all countries. They're for the United States, they're for Ireland, they're for Europe, they're for Japan, they're for the whole world. And every country has to think about how to integrate these goals. And yet, I was talking to the Deputy Secretary General in Dublin the other day, Amina Mohammed. She was in Ireland for a very good event for an Irish aid agency called Concern Worldwide, which does great work. Mm. And because it was the 50th anniversary, she was there. And she was saying somewhat ruefully, You know, there are still heads of state in the world who don't know what the 17 Sustainable Development Goals are. Mm. You know, never mind. And they're not working with their governments in the way that that Amina would like to see, and that we should see. That you know, that this is an agenda that was seriously negotiated in 2015 and is the right agenda for our world to put us on course for a safe world and not only a safe but a sustainable, good world for young people, mm. where they'll have jobs, where they'll have a future, where they'll have hope, and they'll also have that sense of solidarity, which is at the heart of the goals, leave no one behind. And even a phrase that I never heard in an international agreement, prioritise the furthest behind first, which is an extraordinary commitment. And if we only would do that, it would actually change development quite a lot in how we do it. The Sustainable Development Goals, I feel, are extraordinarily important for climate justice, but also are a great hope for the world. And we mustn't allow, you know, the current populism and divisiveness that has entered the world to make us forget that we actually have this agenda,
yes.
That it is the agenda for our world.
You've been listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. Ours is a non-profit membership organization. We're dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter. Please join us at worldaffairs.org. This program featured Musimbi Kanyoro, President and CEO of the Global Fund for Women, Mary Robinson, former President of Ireland, and she now leads the Mary Robinson Foundation. Their conversation was moderated by Heather Grady of the Rockefeller Philanthropy Advisors. This broadcast is made possible each week by the generous support of VMware and the Draper Richards Kaplan Foundation. Our technical supervisor is Monte Carlos. World Affairs is produced in association with KQED Public Radio. I'm Jane Wales. Thank you for joining us.